Vancouver Institute series of Saturday night lectures. Our final lecture of the season will be held next Saturday on April the 3rd. The speaker is Professor G.J. Wasserberg of the Department of Geological and Planetary Sciences of the California Institute of Technology, who will speak on the subject stars, gas, dust, and planets. And we warmly invite you to attend. Usually at this point in my introduction, just before introducing the speaker to you, I try to cajole you into becoming a member of the Institute. My weapons have been jokes and humor, my target, your pocketbook, my objective, the solvency of the Institute. However, there are occasions when jokes and humor are inappropriate. They jar with the gravity and seriousness of the occasion and only produce embarrassed laughter. A lecture on Poland and the future of Eastern Europe is serious business, not light entertainment. So if you need a reason for joining the Institute tonight, I can provide you with a serious reason. There is no equivalent of the Vancouver Institute in Poland. Our speaker this evening, Professor H. Gordon Skilling, has had a long and distinguished academic career. In fact, Professor Dennis Chitty, who attended the University of Toronto contemporaneously with Professor Skilling, has drawn to my attention certain facts that Professor Skilling had, if not concealed, had not gone out of his way to draw to my attention. And they included the fact that he was the social director of the University College Literary and Athletic Society Executive of the University of Toronto in 1932-33, in a distinguished class which included the present Chief Justice, Bora Laskin, A.F.W. Plumtree, a former distinguished civil servant, Arnold Smith, a distinguished international servant, plus Professor Skilling himself. And it indicates Professor Skilling's contribution to the social life of the university in that period. That was followed by Professor Skilling, at that time, of course, not a professor, being selected by the Rhodes Scholarship Committee of Ontario to be a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University in the 30s. He received his doctorate degree from the University of London in 1940 for a thesis on Czech-German national conflict in Bohemia. Professor Skilling has taught at the University of Wisconsin, Dartmouth College, Columbia University, and other institutions. Since 1959, he has been a professor in the Department of Political Economy at the University of Toronto, and for 11 years was the director of the Center for Russian and East European Studies at that university. Professor Skilling has published 7 books and many articles and chapters in books primarily dealing with the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. In recent years, he has been in close touch with the movement for human rights in Czechoslovakia, Charter 77, has interviewed many of its leading figures, and has built up a massive collection of samizdat materials. His most recent book, published last year, deals with human rights in Czechoslovakia. Professor Skilling was made a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada in 1970. Last year, in 1981, he was honored by the award of the Innis Jarin Medal of the Royal Society for continuous contributions to the social sciences. Given the events of recent months, there are few subjects of greater contemporary political significance than Poland and the future of Eastern Europe. No speaker is better qualified to grapple with the complexities of such a subject than our speaker for this evening, Professor Gordon Skilling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, I didn't realize that Professor Cairns was going to indulge in ancient history. And in speaking on the subject of Poland, one is tempted to begin with ancient history and to discuss the historical background of Polish events, of the Poles as a people and of Poland as a nation. I must carefully guard against this, however, this temptation. I remember during World War II that we invited a distinguished Polish professor to speak on the subject Poland and the War. He spoke for an hour and a half, and by that time had reached the second partition of Poland, 1792. That I want to avoid, so you'll have to forgive me if I skip the history and plunge right into the present. The establishment of a military dictatorship is commonplace. We've had two recent ones within the past week in Bangladesh and in Guatemala. We've had military dictatorships in European countries too, not so long ago, in Portugal, in Spain, and in Greece. So that the establishment of a military junta in Poland, in terms of world politics, is not a unique event. It's a common event. But what makes this very unique, that it is the establishment of a military junta in a communist system. The first time, I think, that this has happened, since in most communist systems, perhaps without exception, the military has been firmly and securely subordinated to the ruling Communist Party. First time that I know of, that I can remember, that the military has displaced a ruling Communist Party and taken over the enormous task of governing a bankrupt country and a rebellious country. This is not the first crisis in Poland. Indeed, it's but one of a series of fundamental crises that have shaken the Polish communist system to its foundations. From 1956 through 1968, 1970, 1976, and now most recently in 1980. Nor is it the first set of crises in Eastern Europe. In fact, on the contrary, Poland is not alone in having experienced such basic breakdowns of the communist system. There have, in fact, been three such comparable breakdowns. The one in Hungary, which I in 1956, the crisis in Czechoslovakia, followed by the invasion of that country by Soviet armed forces in 1968, and now the Polish crisis of 1980-81, followed by the indirect Soviet intervention by the establishment of a military dictatorship. And I'd like to start this analysis of Poland by arguing the essential similarity of these great crises that have occurred in East European communism at 12-year intervals, 56, 68, and 80. And indeed, I would add, that there have been many minor crises, not quite comparable to the convulsions of Poland and Czechoslovakia and Hungary, but minor but important crises that have shaken the communist systems in these countries and in other countries of Eastern Europe. Moreover, there have been crises of a different kind where communist systems in Eastern Europe have not gone through the convulsions of a movement for reform comparable to the three that I've mentioned, but have gone through a process of declaration of independence, one might say, from Soviet rule or control, as in the case of Yugoslavia in 48, Albania in 1961, and the partial declaration of independence of Romania in 1964. So that I think one can safely say that during the 50-odd years of 40-odd years of communist rule in Eastern Europe, the individual systems, with one or two exceptions, and the Soviet bloc system as a whole, has been in a state of almost constant crisis. And these crises have had something in common, which I will mention very briefly before examining the Polish case in particular. The essential similarity of the crises was emphasized in a samizdat essay, typewritten essay circulating in Czechoslovakia by a good friend of mine, Milan Szymeczka, dismissed after the Prague Spring in 69 from the university in Bratislava and now working as a construction worker. But in a brilliant essay trying to compare Czechoslovakia in 1968 with Poland in 1980, he argued that the common element of these critical breakdowns of the communist system in the two countries, and I think this applies to Hungary and to a lesser extent to the other countries of Eastern Europe, the common essential feature was, quote, the failure of the political and economic system, which was forced on these countries in the post-war years, and which was not capable of adapting to the real needs of these countries. Szymeczka argued that this was the essential common feature of Czechoslovakia and of Poland. And one could, had one the time, examine the constituent elements of this kind of crisis. It was first of all an economic crisis, very pronounced in the case of Poland, but a breakdown of the planned economic system, resulting in large part from the fact that it was a highly centralized and so-called command economy in which everything was regulated and controlled from the center and there was no free play of economic forces permitted. Coupled with that was a political crisis of the first magnitude, resulting from the fact that all power was concentrated in the hands of a single party, the Communist Party, or as in the case of Poland it was called, the Polish United Workers' Party, but in essence a Communist Party. And this concentration of power in a single party involved the almost complete exclusion of the population at large from any genuine participation in the public affairs of the country, and the indeed the transformation of the Communist Party itself into a monolithic organization run by a top leadership of a few people in which the average Communist Party member had little or no say. And this economic and political crisis was supplemented and made worse by an intellectual crisis of the highest order, resulting from the system of total censorship and complete control of all means of publication and media of communication, as well as the enforcement in the schools, the universities, and in the press of a single dominant ideology, the ideology of Marxism-Leninism. There are many other aspects of the crises of Eastern Europe that one could mention, but these, it seems to me, are three of the salient points that are common to all the countries that have experienced the critical experiences that I have mentioned. And in each case, in the three major instances that I have mentioned, Hungary, Poland and Czechoslovakia, but also elsewhere, there emerged as a result of this situation massive reform movements at certain critical turning points in the history of the countries concerned, where a mass movement developed for reform, for the elimination of the ills of the system, and for the development of at least new forms of communism, or as in Dubček's phrase in Czechoslovakia, a human kind of socialism, giving socialism or communism a human face. And among the common reforms developed in Poland and elsewhere was, first of all, in the economic field, the proposal for far-reaching decentralization of the economy, and the introduction into the planned system of important elements of a market, so that individual entrepreneurs, managers of industry, would be able to make decisions independent of central control. This was often coupled in the reform programs with the idea of workers' self-management, involving in most cases the idea of the election of workers' councils in each factory or enterprise and the sharing of power by those workers' councils with the managerial elements of the enterprise. Secondly, there was usually involved in the reform programs an attempt to broaden public participation, not to challenge the ruling Communist Party, but accepting it as a fact that couldn't be changed, to try to at least democratize the Communist Party internally and to extend to the population at large a certain degree of participation, not through free political parties or free elections, but by some degree of participation on their part in the local organs of government and in the factories and so on. And also common to the reform program was, of course, the idea of abolishing the intellectual controls, either eliminating completely censorship or limiting it severely, and assuring freedom of expression in all spheres, in scholarship, in the arts and culture, in education, and the like. And if one examines the Solidarity Program in Poland, published, agreed at the Solidarity Congress in the middle of the summer of 1981 and published, one can see all of these elements and many more brought together in a very far-reaching plan proposed by Solidarity for literally for the transformation of the system in all its aspects and the establishment, as they said, of a self-governing independent republic. So that, by way of background, to indicate that Poland and the Polish case was not unique, but was really an expression of a common movement in Eastern Europe for these objectives that I have outlined very briefly. Now, the movement in Poland that began in August 1980 with the strikes on the Baltic coast and the spreading of strikes throughout the whole country was quite distinct from anything that had happened before. And I think perhaps this is the central point of my lecture. And I want to make that clear at the outset in general terms and then examine some of the rather distinctive features of the Polish reform movement. But in general terms, one could say, I think, as a sweeping generalization, that the reform movements elsewhere in Eastern Europe at other times, and notably the Czechoslovak reform movement in 68 and the Hungarian in 1956, those reform movements were what might be called revisionist reform movements. They were attempts to revise the Communist Party system from within and from above. They were usually led by the party and directed by the party, these attempted reforms. The leading spirits were party members, often intellectuals, who propagated the ideas of change in all spheres, and looked, in other words, to the elimination of the worst aspects of Communist Party rule and to create a more decent, a more just, a more equitable communist system. And I think that, broadly speaking, one can say that all of the movements for reform were of this revisionist character. Revisionism is the term used to describe, then, a movement within the party, led by the party, and carried through in large part by party members. What was distinctive and unusual about the Polish movement for reform that began with the forming of Solidarity in 1980 was the fact that it was I would say, post-revisionist. It was the first example of a serious and fundamental effort to transform the communist system from outside, and by actions not of the party leadership itself, not of Communist Party members, but by actions of non-communists acting outside the party and trying to press on the party their program of change and reform. And I think, therefore, it breaks new ground and marks perhaps a historic turning point in East European communist history. Not that I exclude the possibility of a possible revisionism in one or other East European country in the future. It's still conceivable, I suppose, that a communist party and its leadership will try to change the system from above while preserving the communist party rule. But this now seems to be a post-revisionist phase that we have entered, in which hope is more or less abandoned that real change will come from above and within the party, and that effective and real change will have to come from below and from outside the party. Now to go on to examine some of the quite distinctive and unusual features of the Polish movement for reform, or the movement for renewal, as it's called in Polish. And I mentioned, I think, four of these. First of all, the role of the working class. This is the first time in East European history, perhaps in the history of almost any country, that the working class, as a whole, almost in its entirety, advanced into the center of the stage as the major agent of change. It was almost as Marx had predicted it, except that the workers were not rising against capitalism, but against a deformed form of socialism. The role of the working class in the Polish reform movement was crucial and central. The emergence of solidarity as the result of the strike movement of August in the summer of 1980 created a massive independent trade union movement, 10 million strong, embracing in its membership almost the entire working class of Poland. With one blow, the forming of this solidarity movement discredited the Communist Party, which had always claimed to be the party of the working class, the spokesman of the proletariat. It could no longer do so, even in theory, in Poland, after Solidarity had won its legitimacy as the real spokesman of the working class after August 1980. This had profound political implications, going far beyond the original reasons for the forming of Solidarity. Solidarity was formed largely as a protest against economic conditions, and particularly against the increase of prices dictated from the center by the government, and in favor of higher wages. It was a typical trade union movement, in other words, seeking economic ends primarily, and organizing itself into the first free trade union in communist history. But it became much more than that. As the summer wore on, and 1980 passed, the Solidarity movement became a political force of great magnitude and influence. Its objectives ceased to be primarily and exclusively economic. In fact, they were never exclusively economic, but they had, even from the beginning in the negotiations in Gdansk between Solidarity and the government, they had advanced political objectives too, but they increasingly became the spokesman, we might say, for the general reform of the entire system of Polish communism, with the characteristic reform objectives that I've already outlined. What they were seeking, in other words, was a complete transformation of the system within the framework of communist rule and recognizing and accepting the, at least temporarily and for a long time to come, the exclusive rule of the Communist Party. It became, in its own words, a social movement, not just the trade union, representing the interests of society as a whole, so they claimed, and the chief guarantor of the renewal process, as the program reads. Now, there is criticism after the event of solidarity, certainly in the West, and I think at home too, in Poland. Did it go too far, and did it go too fast? Was it becoming too much a political movement that could not possibly be accepted, either by the ruling Communist Party and particularly by the Soviet regime? I think one has to understand a number of things before making a critical judgment of solidarity, and I'm not even sure that one is entitled in the West to make such a critical judgment. One can't stand really on the sidelines of a revolution and tell the revolutionaries that they're going too fast or they're doing the wrong thing or they're raising extremist demands. One can, I suppose, but I don't know whether one has the right and whether it has really much legitimacy, since a revolution, and this was a revolution, nonviolent, has its own momentum. And if it does not press forward drastically and with sometimes quite radical demands, then it is likely to be defeated. And indeed, it may never get started if the warning voices carry the day and they are too cautious and too careful. But I want to point out the fact that among the reasons for the growing militancy of the solidarity movement that has been criticized were two facts. First of all, the increasingly desperate economic situation in Poland, which you all are familiar with from television and newspaper reporting, a desperate situation of shortages, and in view of the coming winter, threatening the very life of many of the population. So I think this feeling of economic desperation on the part of the population naturally reflected itself in the solidarity movement that sought to express popular views. Secondly, I think the increasing politicization and militancy of solidarity resulted from the failure of the regime, the party-led regime, to take up the cause of reform and to identify itself with it. But on the contrary, its slowness and its hesitation and its attempt to delay or to block, indeed, the whole reform movement. Of that I'll say more later. I'd also like to point out that the solidarity movement was an extremely democratic movement. And in a country that had not known democracy for 40 or 50 years, it was feeling its way, learning again how to act in a democratic way. But as a democratic movement, it had widespread differences of view in its membership and in its leadership, and therefore great conflicts of view and tension between the more militants on the one side and the more moderate elements on the other. On the whole, I think one can say, justly, that at the time of the military takeover, Lech Wałęsa, the leader of the solidarity movement, was in control of the movement, and as a moderate, was seeking to direct its course in a reasonable manner so as to try to reach a consensus with the ruling party and the government, and to achieve a kind of partnership, if you will, between the new solidarity movement and the Polish United Workers' Party. That's not to say that his control of the movement might not have lasted, and under the pressure of the forces that I have mentioned, the militants might eventually have been able to displace him and to replace him. But that had not happened at the time of the military takeover. And I think, therefore, it is important to stress the fact that at that point, one can hardly point the finger place the blame for the establishment of the military dictatorship on the so-called extremist demands of solidarity. Rather, I would put the blame, as I shall point out in a moment, on the failure of the rulers, party leadership, to grasp the program and take the leadership in the reform movement. So that, I think, is one feature of the movement that marks this reform or renewal process off from any previous reform movement in Eastern Europe. And it may be that such a movement will never occur again, since the working class of other countries of Eastern Europe have not displayed the same militancy and political organizational ability. A second feature that I'd like to mention is the role of the intellectuals. This was not just a bipolar situation with the Solidarity Workers Movement facing the Communist Party leadership. But what we had in 1980-81 was the growth of a really pluralistic society with all social forces coming onto the stage, presenting their demands, and organizing independent associations and organizations for the defense of those demands, particularly among the intellectuals. The intellectuals played a leading role as advisors of Solidarity, and they also participated in the Solidarity movement as members, since the Solidarity trade union movement extended into universities, schools, institutions of all kinds, and embraced, therefore, people whom we might call intellectuals and others. Moreover, the intellectuals formed their own organizations. Independent students' movement was created throughout all of Poland and all universities. An independent, the Writers' Association, which had always existed, was transformed into an independent democratic organization under non-communist leadership. The journalists, likewise, their association was completely changed into a democratic association led also by non-communists. So that I think, and then finally among the peasants, a movement for rural solidarity was created, and an organization under that name was created to defend the interests of the farming population of Poland. So what you had really was the mobilization of the entire society, of all social forces, all social classes, partly under the leadership of Solidarity, although not exclusively so, but an extraordinary demonstration of national unity, I would say, unlike almost any other reform movement in Eastern Europe, although there were comparable movements in the Prague Spring of all social classes. There, the working class was not the leading force, and in fact was more a supporter of the intellectuals, and the peasants played a relatively minor role. This is the first time, in other words, that you've had an organized unity of the reform movement embracing workers, intellectuals, and indeed all social forces. And under leadership, not of the party, as in the case of the Prague Spring in 1968, but under the leadership of an independent, non-communist organization, Solidarity. A third distinctive and unique aspect of the Polish development was the role of the Catholic Church. As you know, I'm sure, all Poles are Catholics. There are very few Protestants, and it is a country in which the Church has always played an important role. The Church, of course, is primarily a religious force. Its influence is in the realm of faith and belief, but it's also an embodiment of Polish nationalism as a result of Polish history and the fusion of Catholicism and Polish nationalism. And it gradually was able, in the 60s, to free itself from the fetters of Communist Party control that had been established in the 50s, and under Cardinal Wyszynski, it had defended its own independence and become, in the words of many, a kind of opposition, a state within a state, with its own Catholic ideology countering the dominant official Marxist-Leninist ideology. The election of a Polish pope strengthened the position of the church in Poland, and his visit to Poland prior to, in 1979, was an extraordinary galvanizing event, which brought out among Poles the feeling of independence and the desire to act independently rather than to continue on the old course. Parallel with the Catholic Church as a hierarchy, as an institutional hierarchy, with the cardinal at the top and a pope in Rome, parallel with that was a very important and rather very unusual religious dissent movement, Catholic dissent movement, of intellectuals primarily, that has no counterpart in other East European countries. This dissent movement had its own newspapers, its own journals, its own clubs, and indeed the Catholic Church had its own university in Poland, with Catholic intellectuals playing an important part both in that university and in the dissent movement that I mentioned. So that prior to Solidarity, you had an extraordinary and unusual role played by the Polish Church. And with the development of Solidarity, as you know, the Church threw its weight behind the Solidarity movement, supported its objectives, and tried to mediate between the Solidarity and the ruling party, often intervening directly in contentious local issues, trying to seek compromises and agreements. It became, in other words, more and more a political force, although as a church it couldn't advance right onto the political stage and play a directly political role. I turn now to the forces opposed to reform, and those are primarily the party and the army. The party had lost much of its legitimacy as a result of the successive crises from 1956 on to 1980. And its ideological legitimacy, as I noted earlier, was literally destroyed with the organization of Solidarity as a mass movement of the working class. As the summer of 1980 went on and 1981 passed, it became clearer and clearer that the Polish party, although paying lip service to reform, was not willing to take the leadership in that reform and was in fact dragging its feet. It made grudging concessions under pressure from Solidarity through strikes, but on the whole, it tried to delay and even to reverse concessions that had been made earlier. One could say then that by the end of 1980 and middle of 1981, the party had lost really all legitimacy in the sense in the eyes of the Polish people, and Solidarity had gained full and complete authority. There's a very strange and paradoxical situation that the ruling Communist Party, which claimed to be the leading force of Polish politics, was not really leading at all, whereas Solidarity, an opposition force, was giving the leadership for this momentous reform movement. And this is directly in contrast, as I pointed out, to other reform movements in other countries, and notably the Czechoslovak case, where it was the Communist Party under Dubček and a new leadership that took over the guidance and direction of the reform movement and not opposing it. Whereas here, it was the Solidarity that led the movement for reform and the party which came increasingly to oppose it. The party, however, was weak, as I've tried to indicate, and increasingly became weaker and divided because there were members of the party who favored solidarity and were even members of solidarity. It's estimated that about 500,000, perhaps even 1 million, Communist Party members were also members of solidarity, although, as I noted, I think the total membership of solidarity was 10 million, so they did not play a crucial role in the solidarity movement, and there was only one communist in the very large National Commission of Solidarity. All the rest were not members of the Communist Party. And finally, in this brief summary of some of the distinctive elements of the Polish process of reform, was the army and the security police armed forces. In the West, I think most people neglected the army in their analysis of Poland in 1980-1981. They talked of solidarity, of the church, the party, the possibility of some kind of triangle of power, a partnership of these three major forces. It was noted, of course, that General Jaruzelski, commander-in-chief of the armed forces of Poland, became prime minister in February 1981, and later in 1981 became first secretary of the Communist Party. And this extraordinary amalgamation of power in the hands of General Jaruzelski was duly noted by Western commentators as an accretion of the role of the army in Polish politics. But I think what we all missed was the fact that this presaged the military takeover, that step by step the army was in fact moving into the vacuum created by the failure of the Communist Party and was becoming the major political force in the country. In a sense, the military coup d'etat was simply an afterthought, a culmination of a development that had been going on and perhaps had been planned. There's no evidence, but it may very well have been a deliberate plan to gradually replace the party by the army and to formalize it, as they did on December 13th with the declaration of martial law. So that at the present time, one can say that the army is the dominant and indeed almost the exclusive political force in the country. It is supported by certain of the more conservative elements of the Communist Party leadership, but they play a relatively limited role, as far as we can tell, in the day-to-day policy, and have been certainly displaced in large part by the generals. The meaning of the takeover was misinterpreted in the West by many, including, I'm sorry to say, our own government at the time, although I think they rectified their analysis later. But at the time, it was somehow assumed that General Jaruzelski, as a patriotic Pole, was establishing martial law in order to avoid a Soviet military intervention. And I think this view is still held in some quarters, in some circles in the West, I think wrongly. General Jaruzelski is a long-time military man, and that means a long-time communist, since no officer above the rank of colonel can be an officer in a communist country unless he is a party member. Jaruzelski is a party member from decades back, but more than that, and much more important than that, he has been for decades a part of the military apparatus of the entire Soviet bloc. No army in Eastern Europe is independent. Each army is an integrated part of the whole bloc military system. And General Jaruzelski, as the commander-in-chief of the Polish army, plays a key role in the military bloc. It's quite inconceivable, to me at least, and I think with justice, that the Polish army or the General Jaruzelski could have acted independently without the approval and indeed the close consultation and advice of the Moscow military command, which dominates the bloc apparatus and subordinates the National Communist Party, Communist armies, to it. Moreover, I think it has to be recognized that this was much, much more than the establishment of martial law as it was described in the West. And our Prime Minister referred at the very beginning of these events to these measures and said, I think, something to the effect that such emergency military measures are sometimes necessary in a country. And certainly better than civil war or anarchy. I think this was a misreading of the situation in Poland. And Mr. Trudeau was not alone in this misreading. This was a military coup. It was a takeover by the military comparable to that of Guatemala or Bangladesh. It was not just a temporary limited introduction of emergency martial law measures. It was the takeover of full military power in a coup d'etat without even the formal participation of the party. General Jaruzelski, in his speech introducing martial law, didn't even mention the Communist Party as having had a role in the takeover or having had played a part in the decision. And in taking then if one accepts my interpretation, then I think one comes to the conclusion that this was an indirect form of Soviet military intervention, that it was a much more desirable one from the Soviet point of view than a direct military invasion, as in the case of Czechoslovakia in 1968 or Hungary in 1956. It was much more desirable from the Soviet point of view because it avoided the costs, the very high costs of a Soviet invasion. High costs such as the massive armed resistance that would have occurred, almost certainly, by sections of the Polish army, if not the whole of the Polish army, disobeying orders from above and resisting invading Soviet forces. It also avoided the cost of the Soviet Union being forced to assume the enormous economic burden of dealing with the Polish economy and meeting the debts of the Polish economy to the West and running the country against a hostile population. So that this was a cheap crisis will come. And in fact, my favorite suggestion is that it will come again in Poland because the situation there is still ripe for a movement of resistance and opposition and reform. And the prospects of any kind of real stability under a military regime or under a post-Jaruzelski party regime seem to be minuscule indeed. So that there will be a crisis. Poland offers a new pattern, but one that is quite unusual and different from the patterns of other countries and which will not necessarily be followed by any of the other countries. But in one form or another, it seems to me, we have to be ready for a breakdown and a new eruption in Eastern Europe in one or the other countries in the next 5 years. Thank you very much.
Well, our speaker will be pleased to answer questions, ladies and gentlemen. If you'll raise your hand, I'll indicate which of you is to ask the question, and the speaker will repeat the question before responding.
Mr. Speaker, I understand that Russia has sold quite a bit of its gold to help pay some of Poland's debt, and also, as many of us are aware, the Russian state is undertaking great military expenditures in the depot. In view of the possibility of other crises such as in the Great Poland, I was wondering what estimates there may be the capacity of the Russian economy. economy to support various foreign investors and
foreign operations. Can the Soviet economy sustain new invasions and new breakdowns and meet the Polish debts, for example, in future? The Soviet economy has its weaknesses, so is ours. There is a general international crisis that is weighing very heavily on the Soviet Union and indeed on all the East European countries. The Polish crisis has hit very hard, not only the Soviet Union, but Czechoslovakia and other bloc countries because of the failure to meet delivery goals and so on. The ability of the Soviet Union to meet these needs is limited, especially on the hard currency element aspect of paying the Polish debts. They are, however, providing a great deal of help at the present time in the way of goods and services to the Poles. I don't know whether the sale of gold has been for use to pay Polish debts. It's questionable. I see the experts differ on the reasons for the Soviet sale of gold. It certainly may be related to their growing balance of payments problems, but I don't think it's directly related to the Polish economy or the Polish debts. Poland owes over $25 billion of debts to the West. If we renegotiate those debts with them and give them the necessary additional credits, which I believe are estimated at about $5 billion a year for about 10 years, new debts, new loans must be made to Poland if her economy is to survive and she is to repay the old debts. If we in the West do that, then of course it relieves the burden on the Soviet Union and they don't need to worry. I personally have come rather reluctantly to the conclusion that we must insist on the payment of the debts or Polish default. Now, if the Poles do default because of inability to pay the debts, then, of course, this brings with it perhaps default in other communist countries. But on the other hand, it relieves Poland and therefore the Soviet Union of the necessity of paying the debts. If you default, you don't pay the debts. If you continue to be a debtor, then you are expected to and eventually will have to pay the debts. It's a very delicate problem, but it seems to me that in this situation, to pour billions of dollars more into Poland year after year to make it possible for her to pay her debts and to refloat her economy or to get her economy started again is manifestly impossible in view of the present regime. How could our government or the American government justify to the Canadian or the American people the granting of such enormous new loans to a Poland of General Jaruzelski? Now, it's always been assumed since the military takeover by so many commentators, General Jaruzelski says that he's going to go back on to the reform course, that he's going to restore solidarity, at least in a reformed manner, and so on and so on. Now, only that, it seems to me, would justify a Western aid. And indeed, I believe the West made a very serious miscalculation and an error of policy prior to the martial law establishment by failing to work out with the Poles and in agreement with the Soviet Union, if possible, a massive program of aid to Poland on martial aid lines back in the 50s. That, I think, was our missed opportunity to support the Poland of solidarity and of pre-martial law. Now, we've missed that chance. And it seems to me that as long as martial law continues within the rigor that it does, almost no concessions have been made. The other day they announced that disco clubs could remain open till 10 o'clock. That was a magnificent gesture on part of General Jaruzelski towards some kind of moderation of the martial law provisions. He's not released any prisoners. He's not released Lech Wałęsa. He's not reorganized the Solidarity Movement in any shape or form. He's not come to any kind of agreement with the church So that there is no evidence that I can see of any willingness on the part of the present Polish regime to meet what I would regard as minimal conditions for a massive economic aid program to that country. So that this is getting a little away from your question, and yet it seems to me that it is central to the Soviet role, and that we should place the responsibility on the Soviet Union where it belongs. It's their system that was introduced in Poland and that has failed, and let them deal with the problem and solve it the best way they can. They'll have to solve it, even at great expense and cost to their own people. But that's a common thing in the Soviet Union, to build up armaments or to conduct large-scale foreign adventures at great cost and at the expense of the standard of living of the Soviet people. It's their problem. I'm not sure that we should have anything to do with the solution of it as long as they don't give some kind of evidence that they seriously mean to reverse course. And that I doubt very much. Why does a military dictatorship seize power, and why does it reverse course if it's successful in establishing a military rule? Yes.
Maybe I'll indicate so people know. The gentleman there. Okay. Then we'll see.
When we look at the instability of Poland, we normally look at its eastern border, namely the Soviet Union. I'm interested in its western border. And here's Eastern Germany, the Democratic German Republic, that lost quite a bit of its territory, the whole of its eastern territory to Poland. Is there no build-up of resentment from the German side? Is there no fear from the Polish side that there will be resentment from the west?
Well, you mentioned the East Germans. The communist regime in East Germany recognized from the beginning the finality of the post-war territorial settlement. The West Germans were slower, but they have eventually come to the same position. They do not question the present borders. They regard those as fixed until peaceable methods of change may come sometime in the future. They don't exclude the possibility of the restoration of lost territories. But I think that in both the Germanies and in Poland too, there is a general recognition that without a peace treaty, there has been a final territorial settlement, and both sides accept it. On the Polish side, they have the explicit recognition by the West Germans now in various treaties of the borders, and that has led to a subsidence of what certainly was strongly anti-German feelings during the war and after. But I think that is more or less been dissipated by the rise of a new generation of Poles who don't have the same historic antagonism towards the Germans, and by the de facto settlement of the border question. Our own banking system. The question is whether or not the rescheduling of Polish loans is only a matter for the Poles and the Russians, or whether it is of great interest to Western governments and banks as a means of protecting their own interests. Of course, one of the major factors and arguments for renegotiating the loans so that they don't go into default is to protect those loans made by banks and by governments. There are two types, from Western governments, and Western banks have made these huge loans. In many ways, these loans were reckless loans, I believe. I'm not an expert and not an economist, but they were reckless and foolish loans which were granted in many cases without proper examination of the conditions of the Polish economy, without firm assurances that they would be properly used and would do the job that was expected. In most cases, they didn't do the job as that was expected. They were used by the Gierek regime, the predecessor of the successor of Gomulka, for enormously grandiose investment schemes, building of great plants, iron and steel plants and the like, and tractor plants, automobile plants. And these have not been completed. And indeed, they're not even beginning to go into operation, so that I think the banks deserve what they get if they fail to get repayment on the loans. Now, that's not to say that we would like there would be a good thing to just sit and watch the Western banks themselves go into bankruptcy and cause a Western financial crisis. It seems to me that the governments here have the responsibility of stepping in to some degree. They have their own debt problem, but with the banks, it seems to me the governments have to step in to safeguard at least the minimal interests of the banks and to prevent them, if possible, from going into bankruptcy. In the case of German banks, there are some that are so heavily indebted, have such large debts to Poland that they might fail if these are not paid. But although I don't understand the intricacies of international finance, it does seem to me that renegotiating the loans involves a technical problem of agreeing to spread out the loans over a much longer period of time, to add new loans so as to make it possible for these old loans to be paid. But more than that, as I indicated, I think, it will involve also the granting of very large-scale new loans, because the Polish economy simply is bankrupt and needs for the import of foodstuffs and the import of raw materials and parts. It needs credits from the West on a huge scale. So there's no point in renegotiating the debts, and I don't know that it can even be done separately from this problem of granting new loans to Poland. And there I don't think we should rush into it. In fact, I think we should delay it as long as possible, drag out the negotiations, and try to exert an influence on the Polish leadership to move in a more, in less repressive direction. I don't think they will, and I'm afraid the Soviet Union won't permit them to do so, so that I don't think our efforts to encourage change in Poland will lead to a set of conditions which would justify large-scale renegotiation, in spite of the detrimental effect, I agree, that this will have on Western banks. All sanctions have a very serious effect on ourselves. Unfortunately, if we cut off grain supplies to the Poles, then our farmers suffer. So on. I saw a suggestion that I think is a rather good one. Why not refuse to import Lada cars? I don't think that would hurt us. But maybe there are other areas in the economic field where we could impose punitive sanctions that wouldn't harm us. But in many cases, we have to accept self-inflicted damage in order to inflict damage on the Soviet Union and Poland. And as I say, I reluctantly have come to the conclusion that there's really no escape from that course. The question is whether perhaps the Poles, with their long tradition of rule by generals, between the wars may not welcome General Jaruzelski and military rule. Of course, this is a deep tradition in Polish history, I agree, and it is perhaps not accidental that it is in Poland, the first communist country where military rule has been established. The rule of the generals is not foreign to Polish tradition, I agree. I am not sure about your conclusion, though, that the Polish people welcome it. I believe that there are, you know, occasions when great shifts of popular opinion occur. I could mention, for example, the shift of attitude in Czechoslovakia towards the Soviet Union. The Czechs had no long, deep, bitter hatred of the Soviet Union. On the contrary, they were well disposed towards Russia and towards the Soviet Union. Yet the invasion created a change, which I think is deep and perhaps lasting. I think lasting in Czechoslovak political outlooks. In the same way, the use of the army to crush this extremely popular and well-supported movement of reform, I think, will bring about changes of attitude, has already brought about changes of attitude. It's true that many Poles, some Poles, may feel, well, it's better to have a Polish general running the country than a Soviet general or a Soviet Politburo member. And there's truth to that. I think General Jaruzelski himself probably prefers that the Soviet Union not directly run the country, and that he may have in the secret recesses of his heart the feeling that his rule is a better alternative. But I don't think that that means that the Polish people are going to accept and adapt to Polish military rule. I think the contrary, that the longer it lasts, the more repressive it, the longer it continues to be repressive, the experience of the troops who participated in the crushing of the last vestiges of solidarity after December 13 in the mines and in the shipyards, in the factory, all of that experience has built up, it seems to me, a new outlook among Poles. I should perhaps add one point that is important, that the dirty work in Poland has been done not by the regular Polish army, but by the security police armed units. And they have been the ones, on the whole, that have gone into the factories and the mines and the shipyards and have killed Polish workers. But I don't think that means that the Polish people would absolve the army itself of responsibility, because it's only within the military framework of the martial law system that the security police forces have been able to do their dirty work. So I agree that this is speculative on my part. I haven't been in Poland for several years, and certainly not since the imposition of martial law. But my feeling is that their attitude will not be well disposed.
Maybe we'll have three more questions. We are running out of time. If they could be made short, the gentleman here, the lady there, and the gentleman back there.
Why does the United States put such a heavy restriction against Poland? Well, many of the Americans were Polish immigrants. Does the United States want Poland to fail?
Why does the United States impose such severe restrictions on Poland in view of the fact that there are many Poles in the American population? Is that many Polish immigrants? It's a very important political pressure group, I agree. I think the fact of the matter is that in spite of Polish political pressures within the country, the Reagan administration, I think quite wisely, decided that they could not stand idly by after the invasion of Poland, indirect invasion of Poland by the Soviet Union. This is contrary to every agreement that has been reached with Poland and the Soviet Union, particularly to the Helsinki Final Act, sometimes ridiculed by critics. But it did establish a certain set of standards for the observance of human rights, the recognition of sovereignty, and the avoidance of the use of force or even the threat of use of force against members of the 35-member Helsinki group. I believe that it was necessary to take a firm stand in defense of these commitments, which we signed, Canada as well as the United States. I think the Canadian government, after initial fumbling and misunderstanding, came around to the same position and joined with the NATO partners in a common declaration of condemnation. Now, verbal condemnation without anything else, is it worth it? A verbal condemnation is has no effect, except perhaps to satisfy ourselves. It had to be coupled with something more concrete and tangible, and I think the United States administration, and to a very limited extent the Canadian government, have decided to back this up with economic sanctions. No, they don't want Poland to fail, but Poland is making itself fail. The present regime is not taking the steps necessary to revive its economy and to sustain its population. It's not for us to do that. It's for the Poles and the present regime. And if the Soviet Union prevents that and the present Polish regime does not act in this direction, what can we do except to take those actions which we feel necessary from the point of view of international law and the defense of human rights? That's a complicated answer, but it seems to me that this... Now, of course, we have the additional feature that Reagan and, indeed, the NATO powers generally promised further sanctions if the present sanctions didn't succeed. Well, the present sanctions certainly haven't succeeded in effecting a change in Poland, and yet further sanctions seem almost excluded, both by the attitude of the Canadian government, which is less important, but mainly by the West European governments, Germany, France, and the rest, who do not want to go beyond the very limited sanctions that have been so far imposed. Not even sure that the American administration is willing to go further, especially in agriculture and the supply of foodstuffs. Not because of the Polish pressure groups, the Polish vote, but because of the farmers. So there are very difficult considerations involved here, impediments in the way of expanding sanctions, and I frankly admit that the sanctions are not having the effect that one could hope for, but I don't think we can retreat on this issue as long as there is no change in the Polish policy. I'm not quite. I'm not quite sure that I understand. You mean that the oh yes, I agree. I agree. Has the indirect form of the intervention led to a less severe intervention by Western powers against Poland? It has. I think that was one of the reasons why the indirect form was chosen rather than the direct. The realization of the Soviet Union that direct Soviet invasion would bring quite serious, perhaps disastrous consequences to East-West relations. It would bring, they calculated, much more severe and immediate sanctions, even by the West European governments. Again, I'm not quite sure of that, because I think that even if the Soviet army had invaded, the West European governments would find reasons, excuses, or reasons for not cutting off their very lucrative and important trade, and for suspending their credits. But nonetheless, the danger was greater if it was a direct Soviet invasion. It would be very much more difficult for Western Europe to ignore it or to treat it as something that didn't require a very severe and active response. I think this was part of the calculation.
One last question.
Professor Skilling, you were talking about history. And looking back at the historic development of Soviet bloc countries, I see one precedent. 1953, we have death of Stalin. And 1956, directly, we had some events in Poland and Hungary. For me, I would like to get your opinion, the only possibility change now in Eastern Europe is if we will see some reforms in Moscow after Brezhnev dead, and I hope that we will not live too long. It's not nice to think And the question would be that one, that following on the first question, and I see now greater burden, economic burden, in Eastern Europe on Soviet Union. It's quite contrary probably to the 50s. Can we see some kind of Finlandization of Eastern Europe, looking at the relationship today between Soviet Union and Finland? Wouldn't be that the advantage of Soviet Union to have, say, direct control with the army and firm kind of relationship, but leaving some kind of pluralistic society in Poland or those countries which definitely have Western historical, you know, past?
Yeah. Undoubtedly, the death of Stalin brought great changes in the Soviet Union, and with the rise of Khrushchev, the introduction of a reform course, which had repercussions in Hungary and Poland and has had continuing repercussions ever since. That was a great and major change, but it has been almost reversed by Brezhnev, who has turned the tide back towards a more stricter and hardline form of communism at home, and especially the insistence in Eastern Europe that those countries toe the line and keep to the Soviet model of socialism. So that I don't foresee, perhaps put it this way, the evidence of the past indicates the Soviet Union is absolutely opposed to anything but the most modest change of system in Eastern Europe. The one solitary exception where the change has gone perhaps more than that is in Hungary. And that has to be explained in specific Hungarian terms, perhaps. Elsewhere, in every major crisis, the Soviet Union has stood adamantly opposed to a major transformation or reconstruction of the system, even though those changes did not try to displace the Communist Party, and even though those movements for reform did not challenge the alliance with the Soviet Union and the unity of the Soviet bloc. Now, Brezhnev will go very soon, either by death or resignation or even replacement by a takeover by rivals. But we have no way of knowing, of course, who his successors will be and whether they will be of different mind. There may be a Khrushchev among them, lurking in the wings, unrecognized now as a man of some reform orientation. But there may be hardliners. And in fact, the general feeling, I think, among Soviet specialists is that it is more likely that the newer, younger generation, that is, people of their 60s and 50s, rather than 70s and 80s, will not be distinguished by conciliatory or soft-line attitudes. We can't predict it, though. It might happen. I don't think Eastern Europe can wait. Eastern Europe is impatient. It loses its patience every dozen years, or even less, as you know. And one country or another will explode very shortly, in 3, 4, 5 years. So that I don't think it really depends on the Soviet Union that these explosions and mass movements for reform will take place. That they will be successful, however, may be, as you say, dependent on a change in the Soviet Union, if that should ever come about. Because as we have seen, all of the reform movements have been terminated largely as a result of Soviet direct or indirect intervention.
Mr. Frank Lobeer, a past president of the Institute, will thank our speaker.
We're all very grateful to Professor Skilling for filling us in on Poland. As you can see, Professor, the endless stream of question is a good indication of the interest that your talk has aroused. You've pointed out the similarities and differences between what has happened in Poland and what has happened in Hungary and in Czechoslovakia, and the uniqueness of the mass participation and leadership of the working people in Poland in what happened in the last few years. And it might be fair to conclude that the 10 million workers and farmers that joined Solidarity falsifies forever the claim that the regimes that govern in Eastern Europe speak for the working people in society. And I suppose one could say that's Marx stood on his head. And perhaps there is a sliver of hope. On behalf of the Institute, Professor Skilling, I'd like to thank you for illuminating what will rank, I'm sure, as one of the most significant tragic but also heroic events of our century. Thank you.